Presente. Death Remnant. With your host, GMC.
Yeah, that's me. It's 2200 CAST. This is Death Random on Signal Hackerspace Radio. And it's April 12th, 2012. And I am your host, GMC. And with me, as usual, because without him, the show would be completely rubbish. Okay, hey.
Hello.
Good evening. You're standing by on the IRC channels and the Twitters and the Facebook and the Skype and the...
only not the last three.
Not the last three. Well, what's up today? We've got a lot of nice items. Today I visited the movie set of the new Blender movie, codenamed Mango. Also, we will have a talk about telecommunism and the decentralized nature of the original internet. But first, as always, and an objective, completely random, the news. And the news today is quite exciting because only 1 or 2 days ago, the Dutch government approved a law which gives us net neutrality. So from now on, internet service providers, telecom operators are not allowed to decide for us what we can and cannot visit on the internet. So that's great news. Hooray. Also, there's more news. Yeah, there's a hackerspace in Amsterdam, actually.
No.
Finally, yes, it happened.
It's a joke.
They open. It's a temporary space.
It's temporary.
It's temporary, yeah. But there is...
space. Temporary.
Yeah.
It's you, if you're sitting in your van in Amsterdam, that's your hackerspace.
Sure. No, they moved in temporarily with MediaMatic, and it's called Temp Inc., and they are open for business, so you can go there and hack away. Details on that on techinc.nl.
But you cannot hack at night because they close at night, right? Tech Inc.
I don't know. Depends. Hey, and you also had some news, Oki, from the Hague South, Rotterdam.
I heard some rumors about the streetcars in Rotterdam, the new streetcars. They don't only have cameras in there, which are very irritating. They also, they just monitor your... yeah, how you say, your behavior, the middle with by speech control or something. And they're just bugging you in the train.
So
it's not wise to tell about your coke deals in the Rotterdam tram from the red.
Coke deal. I think it's mostly breezer girls chatting about all kinds of bullshit.
I don't know.
I think. That was some interesting news. That's all news as well. So I guess it is time for some music, which I have here. It's 486 Kid with a Gangsters demo.
Gangsta boys see the gangsta girls, yeah. Classical. Girls, if you want me, you know where to call me, yeah. Y'all got my number. I'm gonna go get some more.
So last week we were talking about hacker cons and camp and how many of them there were. I already mentioned the EMF camp, which is going to happen by the end of August in the UK. And with me from London, I believe, is Jonty, one of the primary suspects. Hello there.
Hello.
Hey, you're one of the core team. To start off, why EMF camp?
So, I mean, the full name is electromagnetic field, but it's an amusing name, but it makes for a really bad website address. So we shortened it to EMF camp for most things. But the main reason is that in the UK, there's been no large hacker events at all, really. And there's definitely been no hacker camps. So we've sort of been wanting one for a long time. Some of us have been CCC, some of us have been to HAR, that kind of thing. And eventually we sort of realized that we had enough people who wanted one that we could probably organize one. So 6 months ago, we started looking into it and seeing if it was feasible to actually have a hacker camp in the UK, and specifically this summer. And then we decided we could probably just about do it. So for the last 6 months, we've been really trying to get one going. And EMF's the result.
Wow, cool. Now, according to Rob Groengrijp, one of our Dutch hackers, you have to be quite insane to even want to organize something like this. So I take it you're also quite insane.
Yeah, completely. I also started the London Hackspace, and so 3 years ago, and that's when we didn't really have any hackerspaces either. So I've done one impossible thing. I'm going for another one. So
that's cool. So you probably know Amran, who is currently helping out with actually one of the driving forces behind the hackerspace in Amsterdam.
Indeed, yeah, he's a good friend of mine.
Excellent. So it's a small world. It's a small.
It so is a very
I've
small.
I've been wondering about this because we've been talking about. UK hacker camp. I mean, in Germany, the CCC gives a lot of structure to the hacker community over there. Over here in the Netherlands, it's kind of different. It's like a loosely knit tapestry of different groups that come together ad hoc in different combinations. Would you say the UK is more like the Dutch situation, or is it more like the German situation?
Somewhere in the middle. For us, we're fairly loose-knit. The hackspaces in the UK have only been going for a few years now. So, I mean, while the hackspaces are in contact with each other, you know, a lot of us are friends, there's no real overall organisation at all. And there's a lot of other groups that sort of circle around everything. And there's also the old-school hacker community, like the 2600 groups and that kind of thing. And it's very loose-knit, really. There's no real organisation whatsoever. But we're hoping that EMF will bring everyone together and have a bit of an interesting event with absolutely everyone we can get hold of.
Hey, and tell me something about the scale. I mean, what is the number of people you're aiming at? What is the area like and the terrain? And
so we started out, and I think we're always inspired by CCC. You know, it's the one that everyone thinks on. We're like, you know, we'll go for CCC style. We'll go for like 2,000 people in a massive field, and it'll be brilliant. And we spent a month thinking that. We're like, we're going to do 2,000 people, and that'd be great. And then eventually we realised that in the UK, that's really hard to do, especially if we want to have a decent internet connection. And one of the great things about the hacker camps is, you know, we all have an internet connection in a field, and that's fantastic. But in the UK, that's really, really hard to do and have 2,000 people. So after a while, we sort of scaled it back and thought, well, also we've got 6 months and we've never done this before. What can we do in 6 months and have an internet connection and get all the power in and actually be able to get everyone there? So we're going for 500 tickets the first time round. But we hope to do this again, and hopefully next time we'll do it much bigger. And hopefully 500 tickets isn't going to leave too many people without one. But we'll see how it goes. And the site was set. Oh, sorry, go on.
A lot of people I speak to, they're already looking forward to this. I mean, the buzz has been going on for a year maybe already, and people really say, oh, I'm going. So I think you will have no trouble selling 500 tickets personally.
Yeah, we hope so. unfortunately, it's the site we have really can't accommodate much more than that. We did have one other promising site, but it's the prices they were charging. We couldn't have afforded to do the camp in the first place. So we're going to have a bit more time to plan for the next one, and hopefully we'll get a much bigger site for next time round. But the site we do have is It's in Milton Keynes, which is between London and Birmingham, so it's slightly north. And it's about 60,000 square feet, and it's split into two halves. And it actually has a motorway running through the middle, which is a bit weird. But the motorway is actually great for us, because underneath it are these huge archways, and they're really quiet under there, even though you've got traffic above your head, you can't hear anything. So they make perfect speaking venues and bars and that kind of thing. So we've got some pre-built infrastructure for us, which is great. And one half of the site's very flat and sort of lovely trees and everything is very nice. And the other side's a bit sort of more hilly and rough, but also completely usable for us. And it'd be interesting to see what people do with it. That's what we've got so far. And I think we're sticking with it now, seeing as all the contracts are signed. So, yeah.
Yeah, well, that's smart. Back to the beginning. It's 31st of August until the 2nd of September, right?
So yeah, it is.
3 days?
It's 3 days. It's from a Friday to a Sunday, I think. But we'll be open on the Monday as well for people to get in and out. And if you've got a village that's coming, and we know of a few villages that are already organising, we'll be open for 3 days before that and 2 days afterwards, because we're going to have to set up a lot of infrastructure. So it's but officially 3 days. So, yeah.
Excellent. Hey, and if I would want to go, I think I cannot get a ticket yet. Is there any indication already about what the ticket will cost me?
So the tickets are going on pre-sale in about a week. It was supposed to be last week, but we're a bit slow. So we'll be putting them on sale for an initial pre-sale price of £30. And that's just an initial deposit to secure a ticket. And then we're aiming for the tickets to be about £70. But there's still some things that aren't locked down yet. So they might be slightly higher than that. And that's about sort of €85, I think, on the lower end. It's likely to be a tiny bit higher than that, because some of the suppliers are a bit awkward. So
well, I think that's a fair price. I'd certainly go for that. Another thing that's coming up, I think, in one of the coming days or perhaps weeks, is the call for papers. I was just curious what kind of activities and lectures are you aiming at?
So the call for papers should be out by the end of this week. I say that and I'm going to have people getting at me now. But so hopefully by the end of this week. And we're aiming for the camp to be really varied, much more than sort of the traditional computer security events, that kind of thing. We'd really like to get much more in there. So we're hoping to have a bit of a fairly strong focus on, as well as all the standard computer security stuff, physical things, and actually having workshops for people to make things. A strong focus on science as well. So we've got quite a strong science community in Hackspaces. So, I mean, absolutely all sorts of things. I mean, whatever people will suggest, we'll take it. But we know we're going to have everything from DNA sequencing to blacksmithing to your standard computer security stuff. So we'll see what happens. But we really want anything. So anything people can suggest, we'll probably put on.
Wow. If I weren't already really enthusiastic about the camp, I certainly am now. Of course, Signal will be there as well. If I'm going, then Signal is there as well. And there's even going to be a radio station, I believe. There's been some talk of that.
There's a radio station. We already have some equipment, I believe, as well. So, that's going to be good fun. That will be streaming online as usual, so that should be good fun. And maybe Signal can be on our radio station for a few days.
Yeah, we'll work that. I think we're even using our streaming infrastructure somehow, or hack it all together again. That's the way these things go, right?
Absolutely.
Cool. Hey, close this short conversation, because you're busy and have a lot of things to arrange, people interested in this whole endeavor, where should they go? What should they follow?
They should be looking on emfcamp.org, which has links to everything you might need, mailing lists, wikis, Twitter accounts, if that's your kind of thing. I would recommend subscribing to our announce list, because we'll be putting out the call for papers and ticket sales and everything else that's exciting on that very soon. So,
Excellent. So that's August 31st till September 2nd in the UK, Milton Keynes. Go to emfcamp.org to check out all the details.
these spots are there, I've seen these prints. Don't be forgetting this, or don't be fooled. Talk our conspiracy, just look back. Your country's history.
Undersigned with a false flag. Not the first time I play this tune, but it's a great song, so I keep playing it again and again until you, well, can dream it. Our next subject is actually quite interesting. If all is well, I have on the phone an actual adventure communist, also in London, Dimitri Kleiner. Hello.
Hello, how are you?
Hey, wow, you're there. It worked. I'm fine. How are you?
I'm doing well. I'm just hanging out in London.
Excellent. Hey, before we start, what the heck is a venture communist?
Well, venture communism is it's a research project that I started, I guess, going on 10 years ago. I mean, the logic for it at the beginning was quite simple. Having gone through the anti-globalization movement and all the euphoria around the early internet, when we all had these great dreams of how the internet had new kinds of social relations embedded in its architecture, and we were going to change the whole world with it, and the, you know, exciting events that were going on with like huge marches and what really seemed like a giant global uprising, and then it all kind of sort of fell apart. The you know, between the period of like the Seattle protests and 9/11, the level of state retrenchments, the level of state repression increased quite dramatically, and also the dot-com boom burst. It bust. And it became very apparent to me that venture capital, which was fueling the development of the internet then, after the early days when it began to be commercialized, the venture capital was not going to fund this free internet, this free social platform that we had so much enthusiasm for. So if venture capitalism wasn't going to fund it, then I decided that we needed something else, and what we needed was venture communism. And so that's how the project began. And so I started looking at political theory and economics and different kind of organizational theory to try to sort of piece together what venture communism might look like.
Cool. And there's been a whole lot of projects going on, in this context, one of which you recently presented at the Unlike Us conference in Amsterdam, which
That's
was
right.
Timbal. And Timbal basically goes back to the early days of the internet,
exactly.
Doing stuff we think we now need like a huge corporations for.
Right.
Maybe you can explain a bit in technical way what Timbal actually is.
Well, exactly. I mean, the point of Thimbl, like the entire miscommunication technology series that Telecom Minister does, is to sort of, you know, look at the social relations embedded in communication technologies. And one of the central premises that we're trying to get across is that the internet was itself a social platform, right? The internet was a way to communicate with people, to do citizen journalism, to share pictures with your friends, to do all the sort of things that we now associate with social media. The social media didn't need to be built. The internet was a social platform, and it was completely distributed, and it had all the capabilities that we now imagine social media platforms should serve. But unfortunately, because the internet was distributed, there was no easy way to capture profit from it. And so as it became commercialized, in order to capture profit through the old tried and true method of selling advertising, just like network television, capitalists began investing in centralized platforms. So what Thimbl demonstrates is that we could already do this before. So it takes the protocol that was originally used to do status updates, Finger, and it builds on top of it a Twitter-like interface, so like a microblogging interface, showing that this could be done already with existing technology, and we didn't actually need to build it. What we needed to do was invest in improving the technology that we already had, making it better, making it more usable, and that required investment, which was unavailable because of capitalism. So we call Thimbl a fiction, right? Because just like science fiction, invent technologies that are not possible with the science of the day. And for those technologies to become possible, science has to transcend the level that it's at when the fiction was written. In the same sense, Thimbl is an economic fiction. It's not a science fiction, because technically it's quite feasible, as we demonstrated, because it does work. What it needs to transcend is the economic reality of today, because the economic reality of today is such that distributed platforms, free platforms, will not be funded, will not have financing, and so therefore will always be overshadowed and overrun by the vast amounts of financing available for centralized platforms.
So, yeah, what do you propose as a possible solution to that? I mean, is this just a matter of marketing, or is there more to it?
Well, the central... the central concept is that the solution is not technical. We're not fighting for a technical solution. We're fighting for a political solution, right? The problem is capitalism. The problem is not technology. The problem is not specifically architecting social media platforms. We have a lot of brilliant technologists all over the world that are very capable of architecting social media platforms, and they've already been architected in many cases for decades. The problem is that we have a society that is based around the idea of profit, of capitalists investing in technologies in order to capture profit. And this is not a problem that technologists can solve on their own. This is a problem that in order to solve, we have to operate in broad solidarity with the political struggle in general. So the struggle for social media cannot be separated from the struggle for wages, for housing, for healthcare, for childcare, and the broader social struggle. And that is very much the main message that we're trying to get out.
Oh yeah, I very much agree actually. And in the Netherlands, I'm seeing a lot of politics are picking up on this message actually, and taking action to secure our rights online. So that's one the net neutrality bill that was introduced this week is one example. Mm-hmm. Do you see this elsewhere too?
Yeah, for sure. Like the popularity of the Pirate Party in Germany and other places in Europe, information politics definitely are maturing into a real politics. I mean, you know, historically there's like two kinds of political parties. Historically, there's the class-based parties, like conservative, liberal, labor kind of parties. But then also throughout history, there have been parties that have gathered around certain kind of issues, like civil rights, feminism, environmentalism, and now network politics has entered that, right? And what these parties do, of course, because they're usually narrow in their focus, they introduce a new topic into the sphere of political contestation. And so the fact that information politics has entered this sphere, I think, is a very positive and a very important development.
So even though we are slowly winning over souls, the fight is not over yet, is what I understand. And recently there was a talk by, if I'm not mistaken, Ivan Moglen and Jacob Applebaum on Republika in Berlin. I assume you have been there as well.
Yeah, it was a talk that I gave with Jake. Jacob Applebaum and I gave the talk.
Got it. I'm curious now that things are moving in the right direction, but there's a lot of things to improve yet. Are you working on anything new? I mean, you've had the dead drops. Timbal, I thought, was a brilliant example of
right.
how to use the existing technology to do what we actually think we need new technology
right.
for.
Well, I mean, I'm a writer and an artist. So what I do is I create artworks and I write texts. And while I do think that some of these developments are very positive, like I said, I think the overall picture is not so positive, because the overall picture is that the internet is continually consolidating. And even our victories, the interesting thing is that in these political victories, like victories against laws that are trying to enclose the internet further and militarize it further, these are victories in the political sphere where we still have a struggle. But the real problem with the commercialization of the internet and the centralization of its resources is that it moves away from the sphere where we even have a voice or even have rights. So, for instance, like laws like the DMCA, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, one of the early pro copyright laws that were passed on the internet, these laws were still conceived in an era where the internet was considered to be a distributed platform. So, for instance, if you had a website and I was a rights holder claiming copyright on some content that you had on your website, I would need a coercive law in order to force you to take that content down from your website, right? But nowadays, the situation is completely different, because with centralized platforms, instead of having your own website, you just post things on commercial central platforms, whether it's Facebook or Tumblr or YouTube or whatever, right? And these are private space. These are not public space. So actually, these kinds of laws that we're fighting for don't even apply. You no longer have any rights there at all, not even to fight, because you have no right at all to be on those platforms. You're there by the privilege of the operators, and your right to use the platform goes only so far as you're benefiting the operators and their platform. So in some ways, even though we're winning the public fights, the political fights in some cases, not in all cases, but we at least have the opportunity to win the political fights, when we lose the commercial fight, when the platforms become centralized, it's like public squares being transformed to shopping malls. We can still struggle over our right to public space and public squares. We have no such struggle when it becomes a shopping mall, when it becomes private property, and our right to use it is completely dependent on being allowed to use it by the commercial operators.
Yeah. Well, time is moving on. I just wanted to ask you one last question before I move to the next one. So the fight is going on. What could we, like people, do to further these goals?
Well, I think we have to build on the political momentum we've developed into these in these fights. So we have to continue to struggle for net neutrality and against extension of copyright, so forth. But we have to understand that we have to go further. We have to fight for wages, for benefits, for pensions, for childcare. We have to fight. We have to fight for our general social conditions, much more broadly. And we have to integrate these struggles in order to have any chance of winning any one of them.
Dimitri Kleiner from London at the moment, but he is always all over the planet. If you want to know more about any of this, I would suggest you go to the website telecommunisten.net. That's tele and then a K, O-M-M-U, and then like communist. It's actually difficult to say in English. It's telecommunisten.net. Well, if you can't find that, then I don't know what's wrong. Thanks. I'm currently walking through Amsterdam looking for the film set of Mango, the open movie by the Blender Foundation. And here at the Kerkveld, Amstelveld, I seem to have found the set. Ton, the director, producer, also chairman of the Blender Foundation. Director. How's it going?
I'm not allowed to direct this.
You're not directing, no.
I'm producing.
But this is quite a unique endeavor. I mean, normally, if you make a movie, you get a sack of money, some millions, and borrow it, then make a movie and pay it back by box office. But you're doing it differently.
Yeah, we have the internet.
Yes, you sell the movie first, and then you make it.
We first collect the money. And if we have enough, we make a movie with that. And we do that by telling everybody, okay, we're going to make an open movie. Everything we do, even the shoot here is being streamed live via the internet with webcams. All the footage, all the stuff we do will be fully opened and digitized and published under Creative Commons.
Wow. And did you get all the money together for this movie? Well, obviously, or you wouldn't be making it.
We're still collecting money.
Okay.
But the Blender Foundation has a nice big e-shop, blender.org. We have lots of products, all Creative Commons, open products. You can download it or you can choose to go to the website and buy a DVD or a book. And that's how we can do this.
Well, yeah, it's a whole different model because, of course, nowadays with the pirating movies, you make a movie and it's copied everywhere. You preempt that. Do you think this will be a future for like full feature movies?
At least we are going to do it.
Excellent.
Yeah, of course, next year after. It will take 3 years to do that, I think.
That's a really big effort.
It's a big effort. Like, even for this, I mean, we're filming in 4 days. We work for 6 to 7 months on the effects. And then we have 5 minutes. And we attempt to get those 5 minutes a little bit on Hollywood industry quality, which is ridiculous because in Hollywood they spent 100 times more on 5 minutes. So that's still the thing. So if you want to do a feature film and you want to have it look a little bit okay, you need to collect 2 to 4 million euros, and that's going to be difficult. So I still have to find out how.
That's a lot of money, yeah. So part of this is paid by pre-sale of the DVD. Can you say what percentage?
I think in average, we did this now for the fifth time we do this. So in average, half of the money is coming from the DVD pre-sale.
So wow.
That's good. Then a quarter is sponsors, donations and other stuff, also via or subsidies. And a quarter is via normal income or Blender Foundation. So you could say at least 75% is coming via the open source community.
Excellent. And you see a lot of community members here as well. That's great to see.
Yeah, it's an awesome shirt. Great.
Wow. Hey, good luck in finishing the movie. And well, I look forward to the premiere. That's in August, right?
Yeah, August, end of August. We hope to have it finished. September premiere parties and stuff. And then, of course, on YouTube.
Also here is now Sebastian, right? Hey, you're also busy on this movie. You're doing a lot of motion tracking stuff,
yes.
Right?
Yeah, I'm doing motion tracking. So I'm the dude with the marker fetish.
Yeah, because we were in a studio with green walls on Monday. And you had all these tennis balls there. How is it going to happen here? There's not much green walls here.
Well, no, there are no green walls, but she has green balls on her arm and red balls. But now we're shooting. We have to be really quiet.
Shh. Huge applause from the tourists going by in canal bikes. Are you happy with the shot?
Yeah, I'm pretty happy, yeah. We have to do some roto, like when the arm gets behind her head, but it will be fine. So I think this will be great.
Excellent. So this is just going to be the actress with the robot arm. There's going to be no armada in the streets yet.
Yeah. Yeah, I hope that it would be nice if in real life she would really have her robot arm and she could shoot all these boats. But, no, we will add that in post, and it will look totally great, I think.
Because
excellent.
The model is awesome.
Well, that helps. And you're also like developing, I think, on Blender and teaching people how to use it. You're especially doing like the interaction with the motion tracking, right?
Yeah, well, I'm not really developing because I know nothing about code. I'm glad if I can add 2 and 2 and multiply something. But, I'm doing mostly the motion tracking, and I'm giving sort of feedback to Sergey and Kia, who are developing it. Apart from that, I'm doing lots of Blender training. Buy my new DVD, Track Match Blend, just for motion tracking. It's just... How much is it anyway? I don't know, 35, 34...
I think you're crazy about robots, right?
Yes.
Evil robots.
Oh, I love the robots. I'm doing the rigging for the robots, so all of the movement that happens from it, it's just I've had a bit too much fun, so I'm trying to make every little tiny bit move. Most of it probably won't be seen, but it's there for fun.
Well, that's cool. Is it difficult to, like, because you're combining it with real-life footage, to imagine how it's going to work with the actual actors in there and...
Well, most of the challenges will be for the render guys, getting it to look like it's supposed to be there. The other part's mainly for modeling, so it doesn't look too cartoony and like it's in real life. The movement, it's as long as I'm not doing anything too exaggerating or putting like 10 tons of weight onto a toothpick and having it move off that, it's I can cheat a lot more.
Cool. And so this movie is being made with Blender, open source. The rest of the tools are also open source. Is that something you normally also do, or are you also working with like proprietary software in your other work?
Well, I started on 3ds Max in a studio in Sydney, and then we had Matt Ebb from Elephant's Dream. He joined the studio, and he introduced us to Blender, and then we just all started to get to know Blender, and within, I think, 6 months, we started using only Blender. Still using a few other proprietary tools, but since then, I've just come to love Blender that much. If I have to use something else, I'll only do it if I really have to. But if I can get away with doing a job in Blender, then I'll go for it.
Cool. And is that also because it's future feature rich? How does it compare if you look at how easy it is and the possibilities?
Well, I haven't used anything quite as much as I have used Blender, but from the little bits that I can tell, one, it's free, so the licensing and everything is it's a large chunk of change out of your pocket. And two, just the support of it. Like, filling out error reports for other programs, you can fill out millions of them and won't ever get a reply. And with Blender, it's a lot better like that. You get a lot more feedback, and especially working on some of the open movies, having the developers right there. Like, I can just walk into the other room and say, hey, do you guys want to make this bit for me? And they'll either say, no, that's too hard, we've got to have to rewrite this, or it just won't work with the dependency graphs. Or sometimes we'll go, yeah, no worries. And then they'll come out a few hours later and say, yeah, that's done now, so just update your Blender and it's fine. It's like,
wow. That's pretty cool. So I think we're going to shoot again in a few minutes, or?
I think so, yeah.
You're holding like the actors with a broom. What's up with that?
Yeah, well, there's the shot that we're doing at the moment. It's changing from her robot hand grabbing around the face to the hologram all getting messed up, and she changes back into a huge 3x4 meter robot. So then it's the robot taking hold of him. So at that change in the point in the shot, she walks away, and me and Sebastian run in with these mops and just clamp at him.
If you're quick, you can make it. I'm with Campbell, one of the developers actually of Blender.
Hello there.
Hi. And you also have a podcast on Blender.
Yes, I do. It's about every few months we do interviews and we do just talking about what's going on in Blender development.
Cool. And today you are the courier. You are taking back cartridges with footage to the institute.
Yeah, it's not really that exciting. It's probably the least exciting part of the project, which is just to make sure that once all this really expensive footage has been taken, that we get it back on a computer and it doesn't get lost or corrupt or something. So that's what I'm doing here today.
And meanwhile, you're also developing on the actual Blender, right? How's it working next to the artists while they are shooting the movie? Do you get a lot of requests from, can you please add this, can you add that?
Generally, yes. There are artists outnumber developers by a fairly long way. And so, there's never any shortage of people asking for cool stuff to add. And so that's like really fun, lots of fun stuff to add in Blender. Specifically, though, I've only been here for a little while, like a week or something. Not even a week. So I have only been on set and haven't had much time to develop yet.
You actually also did some acting, right?
Yeah, well, we did some acting, I should say. You and I did acting together, and I don't know if it's acting. It was extra work.
I'm director of the movie. How's it going?
Hello. It's going good. Everything's going super good.
Excellent. Is it difficult to visualize how it will be in the end? I mean, this is outside, but there were green screens earlier. Is it new for you, or...?
Oh no, the visualizing is the easy part. We did tons of concept art by David Ravoy, and we spent a couple months making an animatic, and we had enough set designed by Romka Faber, I don't know, Faber?
Yeah.
That we just, as opposed to having to imagine everything, we could just kind of fill in the pieces. I mean, sometimes we did not have any set, but...
Cool. I also wrote this, the story, right?
Yeah, a couple months ago. I showed up in Amsterdam. We'd been throwing around a whole bunch of ideas via email. And then once I got here, we threw them all out. And Ton showed me a lot of Amsterdam because it was really important that the story actually take place here in Amsterdam, which is why we try to have a few distinctive Amsterdam locations in there. Location takes place in the Oude Kerk, which is the oldest still-standing church in Amsterdam, and on a canal, a bridge over canal.
Wow. Are you going to blow up the church?
Only parts of it.
Okay, well, that's good enough. Hey, thanks. You're very busy. Good luck. Well, I will leave them to it. There's a lot going on. Everyone is at least having two roles. I myself just had to assist in traffic management because, well, it's the middle of Amsterdam. There's a lot of traffic. And of course, people don't want to wait because they are so used to film sets holding up traffic. But once you explain to them, like what's going on, the movie, that there will be robots rendered in later, people are actually interesting and understanding. This was the last day of shooting. Now there will be 3 to 4 months of post-production and of course a lot of rendering on the render farm in the Blender Institute. If you're interested, check out the end result on blender.org. And actually you can follow all of the steps that are following, because it's not only open source, open content, the whole process is open. So check it out, blender.org.
What?
No, not that kind of blender.
Yeah, but that, I thought you would ice in your whiskey.
Yeah, I could, maybe. In my whiskey? Is there whiskey?
Oh,
well,
yeah. In your apple juice.
In my apple. In my which we made with the blender and the laptop. Hey, so that was the Blender movie, which was really cool. To finish off the show, let's do a quick roundup of some of the more interesting events coming up that we already covered endlessly last week. But, well, we have some minutes left, so go. What's coming up?
There is some small event in Köln, Siegen.
Köln.
18 until 20 May, and after that you can go to Amsterdam to the Okura Hotel for a training from Hack in the Box or just a conference. And after that they have a very cool post-conference party. And after that you can go, or you go not to Amsterdam, but you go to Poland. There's some events.
And then later, you can go to Darmstadt somewhere in September for Cyberwar and other Mythe. And then there is this...
That's it?
No, there's something in Berlin. What's it called?
Berlin Sites. B-Sites.
Formerly known as...
And Astera's Wedding.
Yeah, but...
What?
It's not a hackerspace event, right?
No, but it's going to be fun. Well, that's the end of this show, actually. Okay, thank you again for being here on this windy evening.
But still looking for you in the Blender movie. But now I'm a Blender or Vitus Gallery movies. But
you can just Google for Mongo Open Movie, and then you get on the blog, and it's really cool. There's photos from all the shooting days. There's pre-rendering videos. And time lapses of the set.
What was it?
Mongo Open Movie.
Mongo Open Movie.
I always forget what the URL is. Well, I just wanted to say the.
We didn't mention Limesco in Hack in the Box. Amsterdam.
Oh yeah, Limesco is going to be at Hack in the Box as well. Almost everyone is going to be there, so you better also be there.
I will be there somewhere.
I have to do some attribution here because the song we played before the Blender interviews was Mr. Spastic with QWERTY, QWERTY. And the last song I have queued up for the people listening is from Rick Zunigar, and it's called Photosynthesize. This was GMC and Oki.
Hello, and our Blender, Blender.
And the RefSpace Blender on DevRandom on Signal Hackerspace Radio. Goodbye until next time.
911 for assistance.
We get signal, main screen turn on. You're listening to the radio program about hackers' places.